I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Will Democrats Charlie Rangel and Maxine Waters quietly settle the ethics charges against them, or will both want to be exonerated in full trials just before midterm elections? Will we have a new Supreme Court justice by the end of the week? Will the president's drawdown of combat troops from Iraq take place as planned at the end of this month? Well, we got an answer to that question today.
As a candidate for president, I pledged to bring the war in Iraq to a responsible end. Shortly after taking office, I announced our new strategy for Iraq and for a transition to full Iraqi responsibility. And I made it clear that by August 31st, 2010, America's combat mission in Iraq would end. And that is exactly what we are doing, as promised and on schedule.
The president speaking before the Disabled Veterans of America in Atlanta today. Well, joining us to take a look at the week ahead in Washington, pretty much the only week in Washington left before a six-week summer break, is Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's at their radio studios in Washington. And Gail, let's just start with the top of our list. Are the ethics charges top of mind there in Washington?
Absolutely. They're top of mind because what's really top of mind are fall elections. And for the last two times that the House has switched hands, the major issue has been corruption and high-profile cases in the months just before the election. This is the last thing that Democrats wanted to see.
Right. 20-term New Yorker Charlie Rangel accused of 13 ethics violations, including failing to pay taxes on rental income from a Dominican villa, and most seriously, soliciting funds for a university public service center in his name from people such as an oil driller with business before Rangel. Rangel's Committee on Taxes, and that driller ended up getting a tax break. Now, Rangel's admitted to making mistakes. The president seemed to say he wanted him to go with dignity. Your sense, though, of whether there's going to be a push to get him to not have a trial, a public trial?
Well, there has been a push all along, but you know, at this point it gets very difficult because for the trial not to go forward, you would need to have a deal endorsed by both Republicans and Democrats on that panel, and the Republicans have already said, we are now in the trial phase. The chance for a settlement is passed, and we will go forward with the trial. So even if there was a deal, I think it's going to be hard to get Republicans to sign off on it, aware as they are that this, you know, this is exactly what was done to them the last time they were in control of the House, and I don't think they want to let Democrats off the hook on this one.
And that might include California Representative Maxine Waters. She's accused of lobbying for bailout money for a black-owned bank in which her husband had stock. She says she was helping an entire trade association, the National Bankers Association for Minority and Women-Owned Banks, not just the one bank that her husband had stock in. But some analysts writing that both Rangel and Waters, being the face of the party in the fall, underscore, of course, as you said, ethics issues, but also put race on the table where the White House doesn't want it.
Another issue that no Democrat wants to see. The point was made several months ago when mainly there was an investigation of corporate travel involving exclusively members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And at that point, less than half of the caucus said, you know, this is racially biased. Why are they going after us and not after, colleagues who do similar things? And that really, I think, is the heart of the issue right now. This is why Congressman Rangel and Congressman Waters, if it comes to it, want to see a trial. They feel that what they did is what their colleagues did and that for them to be singled out is unfair.
Well, and you say the Black Caucus has a role here because they've got these long-time elected leaders. They win 80-90% of their vote year after year, and they got sloppy, and no one wants to write about it.
Well, that's one of the problems. When you are in for such a long time with such overwhelming votes, there does appear to be a sense of, you know, invincibility, and foolish mistakes crop up. I don't know what other explanation would account for why members of the Black Caucus, more than any other, have been targeted at this point. I've spoken with members who didn't sign on to that letter, and they said, you know, this is not racial. This is just, you know, as Speaker Pelosi said when she took over the speakership and control of the House, we're cleaning up the swamp here. This is a new day, and it means being very careful on things like when you ask for money from someone with business before your committee, No, you've got to be careful. You can't do it on official stationery, and you can't do it in the same meeting when you're talking about giving a tax break to that person.
Well, and as you said, it was a new ethics board that was created by Democrats, ironically, that has come up with these ethics charges, a board that might be defunded if the Republicans win. But I want to ask you, Elena Kagan, do you think we'll have a new Supreme Court justice by the end of this week?
I think that's certain. You've had 25 Republicans come out in opposition. The fifth Republican in support, Judd Gregg, came out on Friday. You can expect all Democrats to endorse this this nomination, and so I think she is a shoo-in at this point. But it's going to take time. Republicans have asked for 3 solid days of debate on it. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court is for life, and it's a very big issue for the Republican base, and they don't want to be seen as just rubber stamping.
They better get going then. Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, also this week, federal agents who've been conducting an undercover investigation into recruiting practices at for-profit colleges will testify before the Senate. Now, for-profit schools are also known as career colleges. The University of Phoenix may be the best known. They're the fastest-growing sector in higher education. Enrollment has nearly tripled over the last decade to 1.8 million students. Now, that's still only 10% of the country's college students, but they receive a quarter of federal student aid. In fact, for many of these schools, they get 90% of their revenue from federal aid, and critics say they're just raking in this federal money and leaving students with no way to pay it back. A recent report from the Chronicle of Higher Education says 40% of those who attend for-profit schools default on government loans. That's more than twice the rate of default by students who've gone to traditional four-year schools. So as the investigation into advertising techniques goes on, separately, Education Secretary Arne Duncan proposed new regulations for doling out aid to this industry. We're going to get to that with Liz Willen. She's associate editor of the Hechinger Report. That's the nonpartisan, not-for-profit education news outlet based at Teachers College at Columbia University. She joins us from their studios at the Journalism School. Liz, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's just start at the ground level. Supporters, like a spokesperson for Republicans on the Senate Committee on Health and Education, say these for-profit schools fill a gap for rural students. Other supporters say these schools take students who get cut by overwhelmed community colleges. So who is enrolling in these schools?
Well, they're more likely to enroll low-income and minority students. And one of the reasons that this industry has been so phenomenally successful in its growth is because of their marketing and their outreach practices. They can come in and enroll students and talk to them about smaller classes. They can come up with personalized programs for them, and they can promise them enormous amounts of federal aid, and in some cases Pell Grants that don't need to be paid back. And at a time when we have a president who's pushing more college completion, and it's a big part of his agenda, and saying we want more Americans to get college degrees, there are many people who say, well, these schools have a tremendous role to play right now.
We're reading that these schools can get 90% of their revenue from federal aid, which leads people like hedge fund manager Steve Eisman to say that they're marketing machines masquerading as universities. So is there proof that they do teach anything?
One of the interesting things about this whole equation is, and we took a look at the Hechinger Report at what you can learn at a for-profit school, is not a lot is known about the quality of their offerings, but the range of what you can learn at these schools is astonishing. You can get a doctoral degree in business intelligence. You can get a certificate in addiction counseling. You can take a hairstyling course for $15,000. You can learn medical billing, massage therapy, accounting, game, and simulation programming. All kinds of things can be learned at a for-profit college, and that's incredibly appealing in this economy at a time with such high national unemployment. The quality of what they offer, the kind of teaching, the learning that goes on is another big question, and those who have been criticizing this industry are particularly concerned about the debt level of their students and the aid, as you pointed out. When you think about it, the University of Phoenix, and everybody knows about the University of Phoenix because you see them on almost every highway exit advertised. You see them on subways. You see them on buses. They advertise everywhere. They received $1 billion in federal grants last year, federal Pell Grants. So one of the concerns that the critics have had is these schools are getting such a huge number of federal aid, and what are they promising students? What is the quality of their offerings? And more importantly, what kind of debt are students coming out of these schools with, and are they finding jobs to help them repay their loans?
Well, and the answer seems to be no, even though, I mean, these schools are very young, and that's one of the problems. It's not as if you're going to maybe find people who are deep into careers because they went to one of these schools, because these schools have only been around for, 10 years or so. But the answer seems to be no. People aren't getting jobs, and they're not able to pay off their debt.
Well, that's why U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan last week proposed that they be required that their graduates are not saddled with too much debt. And he was clear that he wants to protect students from what he called a few bad actors in the industry. Because, again, these schools do align with the administration's goal of getting more Americans to get college degrees. And at a time when community colleges are overstrapped and don't have room for everybody who wants to get in, when state colleges are raising their tuition, and when the average cost of a college education is soaring, the administration does need to cast a wider net in terms of looking for ways for more Americans to get degrees and certificates and training. On the other hand, he is concerned about both the incredible fast growth of this industry and about the debt that students are coming out with and what kinds of promises they're really making them in terms of jobs and their ability to pay them back.
So the administration has suggested new regulation. Now, before we get to that, just a quick question, because people like Iowa's Democratic Senator Tom Harkin have pointed out that the average tuition at two-year state colleges is just $2,500. At for-profits, it's $14,000. So why would someone choose the for-profit over the two-year state college? Is it just a matter of, you know, not enough seats, not enough openings?
Well, that's really a great question, Robin, and I'm going to answer that by telling you a little bit of story about a student that we found near Sacramento named Joseph Carrillo Jr. Now, he was enrolled at American River College, a community college nearby. He was paying a much lower tuition, but he was overwhelmed. He couldn't find a guidance counselor. He felt lost. His classes were overcrowded. He tried to get into certain classes and repeatedly couldn't get into them because they were full. And then he started learning about the University of Phoenix, and they called him and they offered him a parking space. They told him that he could get the classes he wanted, that he would get the degree he wanted. It cost 17 times more than the community college he was going to. But his quote, "What good is cheap tuition if classes are so packed you can't even get in?"
Yeah.
So the University of Phoenix appealed to Joseph Carrillo because they laid out a program for him that was completely aligned with his career goals, that was convenient to his schedule, and where he could get the courses that he wanted during the times he wanted to take them, which is something he couldn't find at the community college. So for him, the trade-off was worth it. In addition, they offered him a financial aid package that made up for the difference in costs that he was paying, and he thought, well, it's not going to be that bad, so I'll take out a few loans. Now, the answer we don't know is what's going to happen when he actually graduates. Will they fulfill that promise? Will he get the job of his dreams? Is he required? He wants to start his own business. Will he be able to repay those loans?
Right. That's Liz Willen of the Hechinger Report on the new scrutiny of for-profit colleges. When we come back, so what are these new regulations for how those colleges get federal aid? Also, later today, Gail Collins on presidential kids. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Liz Willen, associate editor of the nonpartisan Hechinger Report. We're talking about for-profit colleges. That's the fastest-growing segment in higher education. Those schools serve disproportionate numbers of low-income, first-generation, or immigrant students. But critics say the schools also rake in federal aid and leave too many students with high debt and low job prospects. The industry is now facing new regulations from Washington and an investigation this week on their recruiting practices. Just before the break, Liz was telling us about Joseph Carrillo Jr. Now, he was enrolled at American River College. That's a community college near Sacramento, California. But he switched to a for-profit school, even though it cost him 17 times more because they recruited him, they gave him help with things like parking, and they put together a financial aid package for him. It included federal loans. And Liz, states like California are essentially encouraging students to move to for-profits by accepting the credits that they earn at these colleges.
That's right. And at first they did so reluctantly, but some of these agreements came because they realized that the students weren't going to be able to complete their degrees on time without that kind of an arrangement. So, for example, they're offering them discounts and incentives that make it more attractive. We found in a piece that we did with the Washington Post, for example, that Kaplan University offered transfer students a 42% discount on tuition. So that reduced the cost of a typical course to $215 per credit. And, you know, they realized that some of the community colleges realized, you know, we would rather not have to do that. But at American River College, the president told us that they'd been serving close to 15% more students than are actually funded by the state of California. Yeah. And how are they going to be able to serve all of those students if they can't offer them the classes and they don't have the courses they need to get their degrees? They felt like they had to turn to the private sector to come up with agreements to get these students out.
Well, now, because of all the debt these students are graduating with, Congress is holding hearings. The Obama administration is proposing new regulations. They're very complicated. They have to do with formulas that, let's see if I have this right, that would tie the amount of federal aid that these for-profit schools can get to whether or not the students can pay those debts off.
That's right. And it is complicated. And I think that's why you saw a lot of confusion initially in the coverage. The industry thought that some of the rules would be even more stringent than they were. The key word here is gainful employment. For-profit colleges starting in 2012-13 under this proposal are going to have to demonstrate that they prepare students for gainful employment so that they can remain eligible for federal aid. And there's two ways they can do that. One is to show that at least 45% of former students are paying down the principal on their federal loans. The other is to show that graduates are paying no more than a fifth of their discretionary income, or about 8% of total income, towards student debt. And if they fail those tests, they're going to face limits on enrollment growth, and they're going to be required to warn students about potential debt.
Well, and critics of the imbalance, the amount of federal aid that for-profit schools get and the amount of debt that their students have upon graduation, say this isn't enough.
That's what critics say, but if you talk to the Career College Association, they call these rules, and that's the group, the industry group that represents about 1,800 career colleges around the country, they're denouncing these rules as unwise, unnecessary, and unproven, and they say they're likely to harm students, employers, institutions, and taxpayers. So what's been interesting in following this is there are critics who say these rules don't go far enough, the students are going to still end up in great amounts of debt, you have to go further, and then you have, on the other side, the schools themselves who say that they've gone too far. I think the fact that the stocks went up shows you that the industry felt that this was a little bit less restrictive than they had initially feared. But there's a 45-day comment period right now, and so I think that there will be some time and some discussion before we have a final agreement on what's happening here. Again, the two sides are both incredibly passionate about this. There's a lot of stockholders who believe in these schools, and they've made a lot of money on them over the last few years. And there are people who believe that this is the only way to support the president's concept of growing more college degrees and getting more students in college degrees. And then there are critics who say, we're looking at the subprime mortgage crisis all over again. This is nothing more than a credit card for higher education.
I was just going to ask that because, as we said, hedge fund manager Steve Eisenman is betting against these schools. He's shorting them, and he was one of the few people who showed up during the mortgage crisis as predicting that those mortgages were going to fail. So obviously he sees it this way.
That's right. And if you talk to the Career College Association, they'll say that the critics consist only of those who are shorting the stocks and want to earn more money if they fail. But there are also some really legitimate questions that have been raised, as I keep pointing out over and over again. What are the quality of these offerings? What's the quality of education offered? What kind of teaching is happening in these schools? What is a PhD degree from an online university look like, and how does it compare? And also there's been issues in terms of nursing and other healthcare jobs, which is a real growth industry. Community colleges especially, for example, have been overwhelmed by students who want to become nurses and can't get into their programs. Are these programs offering the training necessary? Are they offering the degrees and the training so that people can become certified? There needs to be more of a discussion about what kind of education these schools offer.
We remember at one point Walmart was considering starting a, you know, some sort of a university or buying a university, and instead they made an alliance with American Public University, which is another for-profit online educator. Walmart is going to make this sort of the favored educator for their workers.
And it's fascinating. I am dying to look into that story because they have, as you know, so many workers. They're one of the biggest and largest employers in the U.S., and it will be very interesting to see what kind of offerings they have. Again, I think one of the other questions that we have to raise here is we have a president who's pushing for degree completion and more college degrees and more education. Does having a degree in game and simulation programming or gunsmithing or massage therapy, does that meet his goals? Does giving federal aid for programs like that help us regain our eminence as one of the best educated countries in the world? I mean, those are some of the questions I think we all have to be asking.
That's Liz Whelan, associate editor of the Hechinger Report, the nonpartisan, not-for-profit education news outlet based at Teachers College at Columbia University in New York. Liz, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. It's a really interesting topic right now.
And by the way, we did take a closer look at the Walmart deal. We found that a for-profit has agreed to give free credits to workers for job experience. So, for instance, a cashier would get a credit for a customer relations course. We're going to have that story for you down the road. Later today, author Rebecca Wells. Latest news is next, here and now. A swimming ban remains on a stretch of beach in Chatham, Massachusetts, out on Cape Cod, where great white sharks, up to 18 feet long, were clearly seen dangerously close to swimmers. Last week, Patty Young told the Boston Herald that a spotter plane swerved down to her, and she heard instructions to get out of the water now. Nearly a dozen great whites have been seen at Chatham's beaches this year. They've been feeding on a population of gray seals that's ballooned in recent decades. Dr. Greg Skomel is senior biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. He's been out tagging the sharks in order to track them. And Dr. Skomel, Greg, this is frightening to many of us, but to you it's what?
Well, I think it's extremely exciting. The white shark is a very elusive animal in the Atlantic, and for that reason it's been very difficult for scientists to learn about its ecology and natural history. With this concentration of white sharks off of Chatham, Monomoy area, it provides a new opportunity for us to begin to get some insights into the biology of this shark.
Well, and you work with a team. Now, the Boston Globe reports it includes a lobsterman, a retired Delta Airlines pilot, and you, the shark expert. So how does it work?
Well, you know, we've got a great synergy here between the guys. I can set up the infrastructure for doing the tagging and the science, but I do rely heavily on the spotter pilot, George Breen, to locate the sharks, and our harpooner, Bill Chapralis, to actually place the tags in the free-swimming sharks.
Well, it sounds incredibly difficult, like threading a needle when your harpooner does go out, but he literally shoots the harpoon, doesn't hurt the shark, but puts the tag on them. And then what happens with the tag?
A lot of folks want to think that we can track the sharks in real time. That's not the case with this technology. What we actually are doing is placing a data logger on the sharks, and then at a time programmed by us, the tags will come off the shark, float to the surface, and then start transmitting their archived data.
Well, and why? What do you want to know?
We're interested in where these sharks are going, how long are they staying in Massachusetts waters, what's their depth preferences, really basic information that is lacking for the white shark.
And what have you found out so far?
Well, the five tags we deployed last year all reported back to us, and were able to indicate that white sharks leave New England waters sometime in late September, early October, move along the continental shelf south, and seem to spend the winter down in the northern Florida area. So these are the first real hint of how this animal lives in this part of the world.
Well, why are they here? I mean, the answer seems to be these seals, hundreds on a sandbar, just a few hundred feet right off the most popular beaches in Chatham. You can hear the seals cooing, and you can also see their carcasses with shark bites in them. Is there any thought of moving the seals?
Well, you know, I think what we need to take a hard look at is what's happening in the sea with the gray seal population. Some interesting work done by Stephanie Wood at University of Massachusetts indicates that the gray seal is really just repopulating areas that it previously existed in back before it was wiped out by hunting, dating back, I might add, several hundred years. And the white shark is in all likelihood responding to this recolonization by saying, wow, here's an interesting and large robust food resource that we can start to exploit.
Or someone who said, a restaurant, a new restaurant has opened off
yeah.
of Chatham. Well, but what does this mean? I mean, for you, a researcher, it's exciting, but it's petrifying, not just for swimmers, but anyone who's been to this area, Cape Cod. There's kayakers out there. There's people in full wetsuits going out to get their lobsters out of their, you know, lobster traps, looking a lot like seals. Are New Englanders in for a new reality?
Yeah, I think we definitely are. I think people need to really just use common sense when it comes to white sharks. Realize they're probably here in larger numbers than they have, you know, in many, many years. And realize also we have not had a shark attack in Massachusetts waters since the 1930s. And the reason they're here is for gray seals, not for people. You know, they themselves are just learning how to attack seals. They're typically whale scavengers in the Atlantic, but with this new food resource, they're rethinking what they can and cannot eat. So It's a learning process for them. But that being said, there are certain areas where these gray seals are in very high concentrations, and these sharks are drawn to them. So it's best to really not to enter the water in that kind of scenario.
Dr. Greg Skolmull, senior biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, out tagging the great whites off the coast of Cape Cod. Greg, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, up next, Kids of Presidents. Gail Collins says they're remarkably okay in 30 seconds here and now. Chelsea Clinton and her new husband, Mark Mizvinsky, are safely on their honeymoon, and by now you know they were married along the Hudson River. She wore Vera Wang, he wore a Jewish prayer shawl. The father of the bride lost maybe a little too much weight, and Ted Danson and his wife, Mary Steenburgen, apologized to reporters for being the only celebrities in attendance. In fact, there wasn't much to gawk at or gossip about, and New York Times columnist Gail Collins says that's good, that instead the Clinton wedding offered a chance to reflect on presidential offspring and the fact that, in general, the kids are all right. She joins us now, and Gail, you say Chelsea Clinton, like all presidential kids, had no choice in the matter, but she learned to do something besides being famous. What did she do?
First of all, she went into business originally. I think she's now at Columbia studying public health policy, but she spent about 10 years in the business community working for McKinsey, which is a big consulting firm, and then for a hedge firm. But the thing that everybody always said about her, all of her coworkers, was that she worked really, really, really hard. She really was never floating on her celebrity, which is the thing you've just got to teach kids to avoid if you happen to be a famous person with famous offspring.
Well, you remind us of Amy Carter, who always looked a little haunted, you know, when she tried to grow up and carry on with her life after her dad was president.
Yeah, I never thought that so let's send her to a public school to make a statement idea was all that great. I mean, really, if you're the president of the United States, your first thought has got to be, what kind of school can I put my child in where she won't feel totally overwhelmed every day by her famousness? But she worked out fine. As far as I know, she chose total anonymity in her life. She got married to a guy she met at a bookstore who had a nice long ponytail. And
her father, although a president, did not give her away.
Her father did not walk her down the aisle because he said she told him that she did not belong to him or anybody else, and that's all there was to it. She baked her own cake, and she seems to have worked out fine.
As did the Bush twins, Jenna and Barbara, even though much was made of some brushes with the law during the White House years.
Jenna in particular kept getting arrested for using phony IDs to buy alcohol and things. They looked sort of bratty. They were always sticking their tongue out of cameras or doing other kind of, saucy things at the time. But my Lord, they are the most over-accomplishing good deed doers in the history of the world. Jenna went to Latin America and Barbara went to South Africa, and they've worked with poor children. And Jenna has been teaching in the inner city, teaching reading, and Barbara is working for some global health initiative. And they both really seem to have turned out to be, great young women. The fact is that everybody in the United States, I think, either hates Bill Clinton or hates George W. Bush. But I think everybody could look at their kids and say, look, hey, this worked out well.
Well, but somebody might say, why wouldn't it? The children of presidents, yes, they have the media glare, but they have a lot of advantages.
But it takes an enormous amount of self-control and discipline to live out your life in public without being a news story all the time. And I hate to keep beating up on this family, but you just have to look at Bristol Palin. I'm sure she's a lovely person in her own way, but the temptations of simply being famous because you're famous, you have to be really in control of yourself to go about in the world being both famous and not a celebrity at the same time. And these kids have done that.
Right. Being talked about all the time and not being able to take advantage of it. In other words, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And every time you go out to a party or whatever, you know that there are people listening, trying to find something to talk about afterwards that you said or did. It's a real challenge. You obviously have tons of advantages, but it's hard, and they've done a great job. And it didn't used to be the case. We had more alcoholic sons of presidents in the 19th century than you could count on a stick.
Yeah, tell us more about that, because you talk about FDR's children.
Yeah, FDR's children, I think we added them up. Was it 19 marriages among the five of them? I mean, clearly, I mean, they were all functioning people, but they ran through just a firestorm of personal turmoil. And if you go back into the 19th century presidents, you just have all of these guys that, you know, wound up being alcoholics. And even going back to John Adams, and the Adams family had more suicidal alcoholic sons than anybody in the history of the world, I think. So it's never been easy being the child, the offspring of a president. But we're doing quite well on that front now. And, you know, I'm prepared to celebrate any good front we got at this point.
Well, this got us thinking of Jack Ford, who dated celebrities, Bianca Jagger, and he admitted to smoking pot. You know, he was being sort of your average young person, and yet it got, you know, blown way out of proportion. You have Ronald Reagan's two youngest, Patty and Ron Reagan, who disagreed with him politically on some issues.
And I think Michael Reagan, who is now, you know, sort of formulating a career out of being a Reagan in his talk show phase. But it's hard to avoid it. You know, you just really have to focus on what you're going to do yourself that you're good at. And I have to say also, the thing that this all reminded me of is how many amazing young people I run into in my job. And they are certainly, most of them, not people who have had to struggle with, you know, lots of poverty and deprivation. I mean, they're mostly kids that went to good schools, and they're very ambitious. But we've been told constantly that these people, you know, they're twittering all the time, and they're very, you know, spoiled, and yet I think the world owes them a living. And they work like maniacs. I am just stunned. I could never, if I was coming out now, compete with these people. I mean, they all have 27 different unpaid internships that they're doing simultaneously, and they are doing good deeds on the side. I just think the younger generation is terrific.
Well, so the kids are all right in general, you're saying. But Gail Collins, just one quick thought. You were very, very tactful in your column, and maybe some are going to say I'm being tactless now in mentioning this, but getting back to Chelsea Clinton again, you know, not since, you know, the Nixon girls had to endure their father leaving office has there been such a public humiliation of a president.
And I think the most famous picture of Chelsea throughout her life will always be that one walking across the White House lawn with holding hands with each of her very estranged at that moment parents after the Lewinsky thing broke. And, you know, Bill Clinton, who, you know, we now know his flaws, did, when he was president, set aside time every day to be with Chelsea. I mean, he was very, very focused on that, as I think Barack Obama is, as I presume George Bush was. We have had fathers in this particularly totally obsessive kind of career who, for all their other bad qualities, understood the importance of being an active and responsible father.
I guess that's another thing that maybe was in the back of many minds, how much dignity Chelsea Clinton brought to that whole time.
Normally, you don't just acquire that kind of dignity. That's kind of reared up into you. So even as the Clintons were going through this hideous personal adult humiliation, you know, the success side of their lives and their marriage was standing right there in between them.
As she was this weekend. Gail Collins, columnist for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
Rebecca Wells, the creator of the wildly popular Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood, which spawned Yaya groups all over the world, has another book that is in some ways about the importance of mothers and their friends and how a circle can raise girls. The Crowning Glory of Calla Lily Ponder is a coming-of-age story set in the Louisiana of the 60s and 70s in the fictional town of La Luna, which is also the name of a river, and a mystical force, the Moon Mother.
The air hangs heavy and humid in this swampy state where the quiet La Luna River flows into the Mississippi. That wide, robust river carries life and dreams, commerce and poisons out into the Gulf of Mexico. There I watched the Louisiana coast recede, losing a football field piece of land every 20 minutes. Salt water rushes in through canals cut by the oil companies into the fragile freshwater marshes that struggle to nurture life. I see crazy flames dot the coast from gas and oil rigs that extract from deep in the earth what eons ago were once living plants. All that oil provides energy and carries a cost. It both gives and takes life.
Rebecca Wells, her book, The Crowning Glory of Calla Lily Ponder, is out in paperback, and it caught our eye because, although written in 2009, it tells many stories, including one of a man who services oil rigs and dies when one explodes. The story is rich in the relationship between people in Louisiana and the oil industry. And it's no wonder. Rebecca Wells is a Louisiana native, and she joins us now with more. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, Robin.
So we have to ask you, when the BP well exploded, what did you think?
Well, first of all, I wasn't surprised. People would ask, Rebecca, were you telling the future? This is so prescient. And I said, no, I'm not telling the future. I'm a Louisiana girl, and the oil industry has been raping my state basically since the 1920s. Their greed has also, of course, led them to not fix things that are serious problems and have been pointed out repeatedly. So for me, it was inevitable.
How do you explain, though, the people that we've met? They might be fishermen who have relatives who service the rigs, as one of your characters does, you know, drives rig operators back and forth. They want the moratorium lifted. I mean, how do you explain that?
Well, you got to make a living.
Yeah.
We're talking about a very poor state to begin with that was knocked to its knees by Katrina, the natural disaster, and Katrina, the unnatural disaster, which is how I look upon it in sense of the way it was handled.
Well, and now on top of that, BP. But the oil industry appearance comes late in your book. Much of the book is in flashback. We hear of this idyllic town, La Luna, that Calla Lily grows up in. Horseback rides, long days by the river, a rope swing.
That Louisiana is the Louisiana of my childhood. Now, at the same time, I grew up in apartheid. And so that Louisiana that Calla Lily grows up in is definitely ruled by Jim Crow.
You describe blacks who aren't allowed to skate in a roller rink that Calla Lily skates in, black domestic workers who pretty much keep families running but are in the shadows. Did you grow up in that?
I grew up in a very complex world in which certainly Jim Crow rules were there. I remember colored water fountains and white water fountains. I remember the black people who worked for my family. The complexity is that the black people who worked for my family loved me in spite of the fact that they worked for my family for almost nothing.
Well, another element, as Calla observes racism, there's a class divide. Her first love leaves her to go to Stanford. She goes to beauty school, and there's a sense that she's made the lesser choice. But she sometimes sees things maybe not in a scholarly, academic way, but in the kind of way that's sort of a rural street smart, if you will. I'm thinking of the letter that she writes to then-President Carter and Rosalind Carter when she decides she's against nuclear weapons because, as she writes, I speak as a beautician when I ask you to think, how would you look as a bald couple? One nuclear bomb would melt out all your hair. I am a professional in the field of beauty, and I don't know any cures for radiation-melted hair.
She addresses the president. She addresses power. To use that old phrase, she speaks truth to power from a very humble river Louisiana town with a kind of wisdom, which is really, I think, representative of the wisdom of so many of us. I think that there is a kind of a pink collar and a blue collar wisdom that can sometimes surpass that of academia and that of technology. And I don't mean to romanticize this, but to give credit where credit is due.
You said you don't want to romanticize people and make it too cute by far, but there does seem to be a resilience.
God, I hope so. It's very difficult. I mean, looking at my state knocked down by Katrina, which is still hard to believe, and then looking at this, I don't really know. I mean, there is enormous resilience, and it's an importance for all of us not to become paralyzed by this, but to remember that, at least for me, I think there are a couple of things that all of us, not just Louisianans, have to hold on to, and that is, I believe we have to put all corporations, not just oil corporations, we need to take them and put their feet to the fire and leave them there. And secondly, I think we need to look at our own addiction to oil in our daily lives. Not to get too far away from being a fiction writer, but it's hard not to think about my home state almost every day now and just kind of wake up with prayer and wake up with a sense of the Holy Lady, which is the feminine force which holds this book and gives Calla Lily a kind of a spiritual feminine underpinning. I hope that that spirit, that kind of force that is in those people that are across the parishes, and I have to say this, okay, Robin, you go across South Louisiana and what you see is old bathtubs upturned, half of them buried in the ground, and the upper half painted blue and turned into grottos with statues of the Blessed Virgin inside, in front of which are put artificial and fresh flowers. Now, I don't suggest that people worship any which way. I just pray for my state and for all of us that we not be immobilized and that we be willing to tap in to whatever force it is that holds us up and keeps us with faith at the same time that we have anger.
Rebecca Wells, thanks so much.
Robin, it's my pleasure.